So last night, I kind of took all the explained. I hope clear enough. The negative forces, and how they kind of hold us and capture us. But again, to recognize that they are only visitors. Who come and, in a sense, kind of capture us for a period of time. They, too, are all impermanent. They arise due to causes and conditions. And, sometimes we get caught or enchanted by them. And we kind of lose our mindfulness, and sometimes I think it's called twipping out, and we react, in some fashion. But again, they're only states. They come for short, sometimes longer periods of time. Some of them are very much supported by guess who? Desire and aversion are really supported by sometimes our own confusion or storytelling or reactions. And then there are times when, that's part of the practice is that, sometimes sloth and torpor shows and you find yourself drifting off in a hypnagogic state, trying to not, and having all kinds of reactions to it. In the same way we have reactions on one side to the other side of coin, is there is kind of the restlessness that comes and, again, prevents the mind from settling and being adapting in this practice. So that's all, and then of course self-doubt. It's just like, oh my God, then we're kind of caught on the surface of experience without having the capacity to actually see into what is known as, intuitive insight. So that's the kind of the negative forces. Tonight I want to kind of go to what are known as the seven factors of awakening. And they are just, in a sense, they are a counteract to the negative forces, and particularly kind of the shadow pieces and those maras I talked about last night. And the seven factors are, they really are the precursor to ultimately letting go. But they're also kind of tricky because, in a sense, I could say that, you only need mindfulness. But I think there's some misunderstanding sometimes with mindfulness because maybe it's the semantics of the word itself, because it's been so popularized on some level. And from very much these seven factors, and the way I want to describe it is kind of a teeter-totter, so there'll be three kind of arousing factors and three stabilizing factors. And in the center of it, that kind of is the pinhead that is the balancing act. And just I'll talk about it later, but if you can get this thing completely in balance, complete letting go is possible. Not bad, huh? So now, but the actual things themselves. So first, mindfulness. So there are many different translations of this, obviously, And again, all of we do here, is semantic, so it doesn't mean that you're going to understand what I'm talking about, or you have a totally different understanding of it. You know, it's okay. You know, as long as you don't get yourself in trouble, it's all right. You don't have to understand it all. You just have to do the practice. Okay. So the piece here that is so, I kind of translate the word mindfulness as really this mind full of the moment. And one of the unusual factors that goes with mindfulness is that it's in the moment. Now, that's not the whole story, you know. And you kind of see that, oh, well, I just go in the moment and that's it. But actually, from what we know and from kind of the kind of history of the practice and the material that was passed down to us, there is a word called sampapajana, and it simply means clear comprehension. So there must be clear comprehension, which is actually the intelligence factor that goes with this mindfulness that's there. It only is, in a sense, kind of aware of the moment, you know. But this sampapajana, this clear comprehension, is in a sense kind of the intelligence that understands the kind of the workings and the purpose behind it. Traditionally, they talk about the kind of their four factors that are basic to clear comprehension. And again, I have to admit, you know, I don't buy, or it's just too heady or something, the stuff that the way you may read translations in Wikipedia or something like that, okay? I try to do it from actual experience and more experiential kind of piece. And so these four kind of factors of clear comprehension before we kind of jump on the teeter-totter here, which is so fundamental to our work here. And the first one is really, they use the word, you know, it's clear comprehension of purpose. So to me, clear comprehension of purpose has to do with this kind of double word. It's called Buddha Dharma. So in essence, there is this kind of understanding of the purpose. It's like when we began, we took refuge in this kind of awakened state that exists, that we kind of coined the word Buddha, which simply translates as awakened. And so there is awakened, and there is Dharma, which is simply truth. So there is the awakening in truth, which is this clear comprehension of purpose is simply based on this reality of this path that is the thing we walk on. The second of these, and I always thought they were kind of funny words, you know, in Pali they're a little funny too, and is the clear comprehension of suitability, you know. And, you know, suitability, and sometimes it's also translated as domain. And that really is our, you know, our capacity that we say, okay, guess what? You know, I'm going to go in the meditation hall and everybody's going to be sitting and I'm going to do Tai Chi. Now that would be, you understand, clear comprehension of unsuitability, you know? So it's understanding in some sense, there's some negative there, but of what's suitable, you know, that actually supports what we know as path and that actually brings intelligence to this mind that from moment to moment is being recognized and investigated. So the third one is actually clear comprehension of actually the word is meditation. And to understand this, you know, the Buddha gave 38 different kind of practices for meditation. I think what's interesting in that is 10 of them are body-based. You know, and unfortunately, some of those are dealing with dead people. But, you know, it's like, you know, it still is this thing of the comprehension of of the fact that there is a path, and that we understand that there's kind of right things to do, and you know, suitability, and maybe not so wise things to do with it, and that there are a lot of there's a lot available that can support your process of waking up. Now, the fourth one is translated as non-illusion, you know. So this is huge, you know. So this is one I was going to get to, because the others are, these are all kind of workings about the path. This one is really about the view, you know. And essentially what we're doing in these practices with this moment-to-moment mindfulness of aware of the body, of feelings, of feeling tones, of thoughts, and the Dharma. And these are kind of the, that's what we're aware of. Here we come up to, there are two sides to this. One of them is the complexity of this question. The Buddha talked about this, you know, kind of translates. I don't know if, I don't know what a good translation is, but anatta is, there is no self, you know. So, and it's kind of a what is it, a kind of catch 22 in many ways, because it's not really something you can think about, okay? It is something through meditation, then you can recognize, you know. And that's exactly what the Buddha did. He kind of investigated, he went down to kind of the deepest place, and he said, oh, there is no seed there, no point there. And which can be kind of scary, like, oh, wait, aren't I somebody? Well, the way it's kind of talked about is kind of this language. It's called the two truths. And the first truth is the relative truth. And the relative truth says, you know, I exist, my name is such and such, I was born in such a year, at a certain time, in a certain family, I went to certain schools, I did, there's a whole kind of litany to the relative self. In some ways, the Buddha was not so interested in the relative self. And I explained the other night about Ajahn Chah and how, you know, he met Ajahn Mun Bharata, and his mind turned. And in the turning, he went from this kind of looking from a relative self to the absolute. And then his mind was turned with this meeting. And he suddenly started looking from, in a sense, the absolute at the relative, you know. And he just kept laughing after that, you know. Well, because, you know, we take it all so serious, and we, and you know, he would say, well, I'll get to that, but, you know, actually all that is empty of any inherent existence. You may not get this, it's okay. But it's empty of any inherent existence. So it means get over it, you know? Whatever story you're telling, you know, it actually, you know, Usually it's either something the future or past. Here it doesn't exist so much, you know, and it doesn't have the power. Why? Because there is this things rest in this vast Dharma space. So this whole thing around self, you know, he didn't say there was a self or not a self, by the way, because that's why these two truths are there, you know. And our job, first of all, is to, you know, in a sense, is to recognize that it's in the sense of clear comprehension, is that there is these two truths, and we're going to be playing with these truths unless you become, unless somebody gets fully enlightened here, then you don't have to play with them anymore. But until then, you're going to be playing with these, you know. And you're going to be subject to, as part of that, is it understanding? It's more, it is just truths. And again, the description, you know, I like Ajahn Chah's translation. It's like, you know, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness or suffering, and emptiness. You know, so no self, but actually just in empty of any inherent kind of solid thing, you know, thingness. You know. And these, you know, were designated as the kind of the three characteristics. And they are actually one of the most fundamental practices in all of this. Is to, as we sit here and we kind of go through it, you will note that if you get enough wherewithal, you're going to recognize first that this is just, you know, what arises passes away. So, and sometimes it is incredibly rapid, and we start to relax when we say, oh, what is here is not, there's no solidity in any of this. You know, it appears to be solid from one vantage point, but when it's really felt and investigated, it has no core. So therefore, it is simply a phenomena that's arising and passing away. And you may think, oh well, that's oh my God, you know, scare the bejuice out of me. You know, what do you mean? But actually, what happens is with the practice. And the kind of the clear comprehension of going deeper and deeper into the impermanence, there is incredible relief and incredible happiness that comes from recognizing it. And in a sense, kind of a loosening of the mental grip and emotional grip on things. Now, if you don't get it, you know, there is also, so this is kind of the impermanence part of it. The suffering part of it is also, in a sense, is twofold. First of all, you know, the Buddha never said that you were somehow going to get this body of light and transcend the physical world and always be happy. He said, no, first of all, you have a body. That body, if it's born, it's going to have to go through, if it's lucky, and all of you are lucky, you will go through kind of the years, and eventually, you know, probably you'll either just die, or you'll get sick and die. Is this good news? You know? Wow. You know? So this is one part of that, of the dukkha, you know? And he said, okay, this one, you know, there's not a damn thing I can do about it. He had back pain, you know, in his later years. I mean, he lived to 85, and we don't know for sure any of this stuff, but it's presumed that's what happened You know, he also, he, you know, when Sariputta died, one of his main dudes, he cried, you know. So this shows that, you know, and he hadn't, you know, he was fully enlightened, but he hadn't reached what is known as parinirvana. He hadn't kind of eliminated his family, his history, the time he was born in. He didn't eliminate that stuff, you know. He actually caught, like we are caught in time in that. And we're caught in these bodies, you know. And who knows what's going to happen with them, you know. And he said, okay, I can't do anything about that. You know, you're kind of stuck with that, you know. You, in a way, you know, from one point of view, you can say, you asked for it. But you don't know, you don't remember that you asked for it, okay? But you got it, you know? And so then he said, oh, I have one of the things about this clear comprehension is the fact that he also recognized that there was a capacity in us which, through these practices, that we could actually not taking, we couldn't do anything about the first part of it, but the second part was, you know, it, in some ways it was talked about as like, I don't know percentages, but maybe, you know, 80-90% of our suffering is actually due to our emotions and our thinking, you know. He said, well, now this I can actually work with. And it's really what we're doing here. We're working with this. We're trying to get some clear comprehension on the fact that there is this path, and this path has the possibility of dissolving the psychological suffering and find some, in a sense, some freedom, you know. Ajahn Chah used to have this thing. He said, well, you know, there are these investigations. I said, just put everything in three categories. You know, is it impermanent? Is it suffering? And is it empty? You know, and so instead of saying no self or just empty, you know, I mean, it, no big deal. It's just like empty. Okay. Oh, you mean the me that thinks I'm me that has held on so tight, if I kind of thin it out a little, let go of it, then yes, the impermanence is still there, but the suffering is mitigated, you know, it's not so bad. You know? So there is kind of this art to how we recognize this clear comprehension. And ultimately, you know, kind of arrive at a place that is supporting the mindfulness with this capacity for intelligence and freedom, you know. So it's not as sometimes as simple as it's kind of portrayed, you know, and it'll fix all, what, all things, you know, and that way, this practice is not a panacea, you know. They're good tools, but it's also, it has its own kind of relative things, depending on the view of the person. So this is kind of the pinnacle of the whole practice, you know, is that if we begin to, in a sense, recognize that we have this one, and it's interesting that mindfulness, because the advocation of this is that you are mindful of a sense of wholeness, you know, and that wholeness is it has to be incredibly inclusive. That means that the vehicle, which happens to be the body, is in a sense. The mind is trained, ultimately I think the mind training here is trained to be in the body, to open the heart, okay? Really, that's what it is, you know? And it's a lot of work, you know, as you can tell that, you know, the habit of kind of going up into your head and trying to figure it all out is so incredibly, in a way, it's kind of isolating. And one of the things, you know, where does fear live? In the mind. You know, it affects the body, but where does it live? It lives in the mind. You know, so in a way, they talk about this sometimes as mind training, but there's a purpose for the mind training. It's not just to train the mind to be, you know, a good puppy dog or something. Mm-hmm. It's actually training it so that it actually can, in a sense, be open to this clear comprehension and begin to discern what is available to you. So a lot of this, I think, sometimes is our practice. I do these little things. So it's really this thing of getting over yourself. You know, that's it. Because when you sit here, and I know you're the greatest storytellers that ever have existed, you know. And what I also know is that the stories you tell yourself, probably really not true, you know. You know, unfortunately, you know, they are shaded by the emotion of what we have concretized as who we think we are. Damn, you know, that is just you know, talk about it could be very depressing. You know, but. We're such funny creatures, you know. But there's also the fact that, you know, when the mind, in a sense, kind of lines itself up and contacts the body, and there is really a state of not fear, but actually fearlessness. And so, in some ways, I think, well, what is the mind? It's actually to register. Fearlessness, you know, because without fear, wow, you are everybody. Without fear, there's not like the need for separateness, you know. So the lining up is. Kind of training the mind to stay in the body. Stay in the body is to be, in a sense, fearless. And to be fearless is to be open. And to be open is to, in its most fundamental sense, is kind. You know, I care. I care about the trees. I care about the rocks. I care about everything, in a sense, then at that point is awakened. You know, it's all... There is no separateness whatsoever. No. But it's a journey to get to this point, you know. And fundamentally, it's you know, a kind of a balancing act, and that's where these factors of awakening come in. Because I kind of see it like a teeter-totter. There's one side of it is fundamentally based on... that there is investigation, there is energy, and there is joy. So these are just, yeah, I probably could find new words for this, but this is kind of classic words, you know? And they are, you know, sometimes they come and the whole idea here is that they have to stay in balance. And on the other side of it, sometimes these are all put in a linear fashion, which is common, by the way, more common than the way I talk about it. So just know that. And that is then, there is tranquility on the other side of the teeter-totter, is tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Okay? And so these are what they call the seven factors. But the truth is, You know, I think it's Tony Saropiko. There are actually 37 factors of enlightenment. I cannot, for the life of me, remember. This is as far as I can go. You know, this is a little bit testy. You know, as I get older, whether I can kind of keep up with all this stuff. You know.
Tranquility. What were the other two?
Tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And it's happening. So these are the kind of seven factors, you know. But they are held, and this is the thing. They are held by the mindfulness and the clear comprehension. But the thing is, they have to be in balance. So part of our practice here is recognizing these factors. And sometimes, you know, if they're, just for instance, the first one, investigation. You know, if, and you, I know people, especially in the West, I run it, you know, people, who, they're so good at investigation that they're always like, and they're investigating, and they get really anxious, you know? It's kind of this, there's a kind of a, also a backside to this, and of investigation is actually anxiety, you know? So, you know, again, there's kind of the, we have to look, and these are about balance, not too much, you know? In the same way, energy, you know, and energy, you know, like, wow, you know, sometimes, I love standing practice. Why? Because it's a subtle, it's the inner ear there is having, the whole body is having to actually regulate the body system, which keeps it somewhat awake. You know, I taught this last 2-month retreat for 15 years. And so there were people, you know, standing practice doing all the time. And in all those years, I never saw anybody fall over. That's pretty good. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but you know, but I never saw it, and I never heard about it. You know? So you know, it says a lot for it, right there. You know, but then energy. You know, so sometimes you know, there's such beautiful meditative practices like Qigong and Tai Chi, things that you know help kind of keep the rhythms and the body in balance, and are very, very healing, energetically, you know. And again, you know, I know sometimes, you know, I shouldn't say this, but sometimes, I know a bunch of you may be runners, but, you know, sometimes people go and they run too much, and they come back here and they literally fall out of their chairs, you know. So, you know, again, you have to kind of understand in this particular arena what energy, again, energy balance is, because it also can be problematic, where, in a sense, the body, overamped, I think is the word. You know, and so we have to be careful with the energy on that level. It's just too much, you know. And so another of these arousing factors is joy. And I will name these right now. So investigation is about mind. Energy is about body. Joy is about the heart, you know. And you would think, too much joy would be, where's the problem in that? Except that you lose your mindfulness. It's like there's too much effervescence there, and you know, you're bubbling and you know, all that stuff. And if there's too much of it, then you kind of lose that mindfulness. You know, you're kind of you know what I mean?
You're touching the earth.
Excuse me?
That you're touching the earth.
Well. Well, but you know, I wish you all joy, you know, because it is one of the factors of awakening. You know, a lot of times We don't put enough emphasis on something as simple as joy, you know. And so sometimes when you're sitting there, you know, you may have to rouse energy, take a few deep breaths, stand up. You may go, you know, who am I? You know, kind of some investigation, or what is it that's happening right now? Which are all kind of positive factors, you know. But also joy. And joy you can actually call in. You know, it's not something that's for somebody else. It's actually part of the mindfulness itself. You know. And try it. Check it out. It's like, oh, I can actually initiate. You know, oh, I know suffering. I know joy also. And so can I actually, as part of my practice, initiate it in, which brings, you know, again, these are energy factors. And this is energy of the heart. So joy comes and, you know, kind of what lightens the burden, you know. So these are kind of this factor. I'm going to play with this stuff. But then, and as I said, sometimes these things are all kind of all in the text, a lot of them just linear. But I'm trying to use them for balance. And the next is tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And again, tranquility is one of the fundamentals here that we, the sitting practice is more than anything based on tranquility, you know. And, you know, it does have, in a sense, its kind of backside, is the fact that if there's too much tranquility there, there is snoring. I mean, you know, some kind of, you just kind of out of it, you know. But when it's actually balanced, and there is, and I think the sitting practice, you know, I know you all fidget, by the way. You may not think the person next to you fidgets. It's okay. They do. You know, so it's all, we're all kind of in this thing of fidgeting a little, you know, and yet we've made this kind of agreement to get as quiet as possible, which means we're supporting this tranquility factor, you know, which actually, you know, it allows us somehow to collect ourselves. And, of course, you can, it can be, you know, too tranquil? Yeah, maybe, yeah. But then the next kind of factor here is concentration. And concentration, just like the tranquility that's on the other side, this teeter-totter, it is something we're actually developing. You know, we go along here. And this is not, there's different kinds of concentration. There's concentration on a single object, which really, that particular practice takes one into a trances. You know, there are these jhanas, these really, they're great kind of trances that are very supportive to the practice of awakening. But there's also, which is more what we're involved in, is that we are actually concentrating on moving objects. You understand the difference? You know, one is to be absorbed in an object, and the other is to actually collect oneself around moving objects. And that is really what the insight practice is based on, is kind of being awake to. And you get a lot of concentration from, it's not the same, but it's really what we're dealing with. And so just following the breath or just recognizing, you know, some of the subtleties of that. I know, you know, I have sometimes acupuncturists that come and there are Tibetan that follow the pulses. And their practice is actually not the breath. It is to just to feel the heartbeat in the body somewhere and just follow that, which is perfectly fine. So that is, in a sense, kind of a subtler level of concentration. There's also, which Ajahn Sumedho kind of coined, the sound of silence. And that is, you know, it is even subtler yet, because it is the sound of, you know, you could say the Om or the universe, life, you know, and there's a sound to that. And sometimes that can be a great relief, because it's actually, you can identify and use it as an object to let go of other objects. You know, you follow? So it's, you know, it's not tinnitus, okay? You know, but, you know, somebody, I have had people with tinnitus, and I've sort of, you know, led them to use it as a function for this particular practice, you know, this sound of silence, this sound of the cosmic hum. It really, it's not that, it's just friction. At a very subtle level, one molecule to another, being noisy, you know. So that's concentration, and again, too much of it, and this is tricky. Some people will kind of, you know, kind of catch me on this, but this is what the way I see it, is that it can also go into trance. And trance does not have any insight in it. It's simply a state. You know, even though it's a wonderful state, you're not going to get awakened through a trance. You know, it can be very relieving and can be inspiring and, oh, wow. But it doesn't actually free you. So this cultivation of concentration on a moving object, because it is actually acknowledging, the other is actually you go into a state, and on a moving object means that you are, you know, you are aware of impermanence. It is, that is the function of it. So you begin to kind of get it. So a lot of times these things are lined up, and equanimity, you know, there is a, it sounds wonderful because it is wonderful. It is a balance of mind. But it also, and this is kind of John speaking, that when it's out of balance, one of the things is it's very removed from the situation. Therefore, the heart is engaged. And so that's where the equanimity may be. And as I say, this may be a what's the word, bastardization of the text and stuff. Except for that's what I see. I see that, you know, somehow we can get so equanimous. You know? Everything is one. You know, all is one. You know, everything is everything, you know, and that may not be so skillful, you know. So you have to actually even that, it's like all things. And again, this is language. But our goal here is we've got this thing, and we're you know, sometimes you go, oh, I need more concentration. Other times you go, oh man, I really need some energy, you know. And so what you're doing is you're playing with this teeter-totter over and over again, and it's not impossible, but it's very difficult to get it to a homeostasis, to an actual still point. If you accomplish this, the mind and the heart and body cannot kind of be there. So actually you break the connection. No. And that is, you know, they refer to it as entering the stream, you know, that you break the really this trance of being here. Just for a moment, you know, no one can stay very long in this because you would die, you know, and it's why the Buddha kind of designated that there are four kind of levels to awakening, you know, and you know, it's possible, you know, and one then, in a sense, you know. Your view changes, you know, but you don't change. And a lot of times people have these experiences and it takes them 20 years to actually unpack it, you know. Because what are they unpacking? First of all, they have such a belief in who they think they are. That gets unpacked. They get, you know, this belief somehow that, you know, Dharma doesn't work, but actually the belief is that suddenly there's total trust in the Dharma and what these teachings are. And that all the cultural conditioning that you have been subject to is in some way begins to be released. So, you know, you're no longer, you're actually maybe not even a world citizen. You are a universe citizen, you know? So these things start to break apart, you know. And so the kind of the belief in the self, this, you know, is the Dharma for real, you know, and this kind of cultural conditioning that happens, you know. And then the other stages get a little more complicated. One I will tell you about, the eighth one, which is up before full arhatship or enlightenment. And this is something about very awakened teachers. There is still ego in prior to the full ego there. So there is still, in a sense, a self that's, in a sense, propagated until full awakening. You know. So it's why you get such weird behavior from very awakened, I can say masters, and yet they behave like idiots. And, you know, I was with Chogyam Trungpa for a while, and, you know, and I liked him very much, and he was a really good friend and stuff, but he was a drunk, you know, and you know, he would come to lectures sometimes like 2.5 hours late, you know. I mean, it was just, you know, it was kind of like, oh, am I going to buy this? I'm going to buy what he said. He was a brilliant wordsmith, you know, absolutely. If you ever read any of his books, he's just a phenomenal wordsmith, you know. And you know, I'd sometimes go at 9 o'clock in the morning to, you know, hang out with him and stuff, and he'd be sitting there with a, you know what, a Colt 45 beer, the giant ones, you know, and he'd have a cigarette, you know, it wasn't just a regular cigarette, it was 100 or whatever, you know, and it was like, oh, wow, so is this what I would do? I stayed a couple of weeks in Boulder at the time, and it just started, and I said, you know, I'm going back to India, forget this, you know. And he joked about me, you know. I did go out and I got drunk with him a couple of times, you know. But I realized it was not, you know. I'd come to the States. I thought, oh, you know, maybe, but I was wrong, you know. I mean, for me, and I mean, it's the only community that has its own chapter of AA. So, you know, not including all the other things, but, you know, so I'm just trying to say, you know, there is this, in this progression, you really have to watch, you know, because, you know, an enlightened mind is very seductive, you know, and usually quite brilliant, you know, and energetically, you know, kind of attractive, but they're human beings. And we've seen too many of them stumble. And a lot of that was, you know, I always felt so, I guess sad, because here was this, you know, like a Tibetan or a Zen, and they lived in these very tight knit social structures, in the monastic structures, and then they came here in this culture, and you know, wow, you know, many of them got swallowed, you know, and I don't think meaning to, they had all good intention. It's just, you know, they were human beings. So one of the things here, though, is this balancing act, you know, and so you're going to be playing with this all the time, you know, and you're going to have to figure out, what is it, do I need a little more, you know, tranquility, you know, maybe I'm too, you know, body anxious or whatever, because that's really body. Concentration is mind. And equanimity should be heart, you know. So these are actually mind, heart, body, as I'm trying to describe. And then it is this process of finding this homeostasis, which then, you know, all it takes is a moment. And the conditioning cannot withstand it. When it kind of reaches that, you know. So good luck with that. But I can tell you, this isn't some kind of head trip. This is an actual physical thing that you can experience, you know. And it may take a while to kind of live into it, but it is, you know, I always think it is here in this room. It is not, that balancing act is not somewhere else. It is actually here, which I hope gives you the inspiration and the opportunity to, at some point in that balancing act, to let go. You know. So let's just sit for a moment.